independent and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up on Radio EcoShock.
Sea levels could rise as much as 20 feet by the end of the century. It's a bleak, even terrifying vision. But this is what scientists believe meltdown could do to us all.
It's a life or death choice. Like, are we on the side of life? Are we on the side of, you know, an animate world with humans and other life forms? Or are we throwing in with the machine?
The former presidency that we had with Mr. López Obrador was one in which science was not only not supported, but actually attacked in a very violent way directly by the president, accusing, for instance, a number of colleagues of laundering money and so on. And I was very surprised by this.
It's another jarring week for science and dismantling science. Severe consequences drowned in political theater and war. Professor Antonio Lascanus sees repression of science in the United States through the lens of political strongmen in Latin America. What can science killing in Nicaragua, Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico tell us about the Trump repression? Followed by the latest, like Goddard Institute for Space Studies building shut down soon. Naomi Klein asks, which side are you on? And sea level expert Robert Kopp, sounding the general alarm is not alarmism. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Wiped out in waves, never seen coming. Dancing in their graves, machines still humming. Keyword search, delete, delete. Billionaire score, mission complete.
Killing climate news. Fast and Furious, a mashup from the fire hose of April 2025. Is the famous carbon dioxide measuring station in Manaloa closing? Daily figures from the site stopped updating April 16th. The lab on the mountain is listed for cancellation in the Trump admin documents. But somehow the daily data is still available from USC San Diego at keelingcurve.ucsd.edu. April CO2 passed the 430 parts per million mark, the highest in the last 3 to 5 million years, long before humans appeared on this planet. Robert McGuire reports April 21st on Blue Sky. A few weeks ago, chemical lobbyists asked the Trump administration to shut down an EPA website showing the locations of thousands of dangerous chemical facilities. The EPA just took it down. That's right. The government's chemical disaster tracking tool just went dark. You don't need to know where all that deadly stuff is, you with your sick kids and your dad with cancer. Mike Ludwig at Truth Out reports, quote, the Trump administration also deleted the Council on Environmental Quality's Climate and Environmental Justice Screening Tool, which the Biden administration set up to map out areas vulnerable to pollution and climate impacts, such as flooding and wildfires. Ludwig continues, the EPA quietly announced that a list of nearly 70 aging coal-burning power plants received a presidential exemption from rules requiring reductions of harmful pollutants, including mercury, arsenic, benzene, and fine particulate matter that lodges in human lungs, end quote from Mike Ludwig.
Radio EcoShock.
In 1633, Galileo faced the Roman Inquisition. He was accused of heresy for saying Earth circled the sun and not the other way around. Under threat of torture, he was forced to recant his views and spent the rest of his life under house arrest. In the United States, scientists are suddenly being fired with their funding cut. Some receive death threats, and most are fearful to speak. Why do humans fall in love with science and then turn against it? Is this a fundamental weakness in our minds that could limit progress, understanding the planet? Antonio Lazcano is a science professor at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, known as UNAM. He promotes the study of evolutionary biology and the origins of life. His 250-plus publications are highly cited. Lazcano also specializes in scientific journalism and teaching. On April 17th, he published this editorial in the top journal Science, When State Support for Science Fails. Looking at America dismantling science, can we find a map in the clash of politics and science in other countries before us? From Mexico City, Antonio Lazcano, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Why did you write this editorial for the journal Science?
The former presidency that we had with Mr. López Obrador was one in which science was not only not supported, but actually attacked in a very violent way directly by the president, accusing, for instance, a number of colleagues of laundering money and so on. And I was very surprised by this. And then actually looking at what's going on today in the United States, which has without doubt the most powerful scientific system in the world nowadays, I was amazed to see that the same was happening there. Mr. Trump certainly belongs to a much more conservative political position than Mr. López Obrador. And for me, it was very curious to see that regardless of the ideological attitude, both people from the right and from the left had this opposition to the development of science. And then I began looking at the situation in Latin America, and I was very surprised to realize that the same was going on in our part of the world with Ortega in Nicaragua taking over the Nicaraguan Academy of Sciences, with people like Meli in Argentina attacking science, Bolsonaro in Brazil, the former president of Brazil doing the same. And then it lighted upon me that the real problem is that in Latin America, regardless of our rather strong historical connections and identity, we have been unable to develop a scientific policy for the entire region. And it's something I'm very concerned about.
Yes, when I look at science papers and interview scientists, I often find Latin America and South America are almost completely missing. Yes, we talk about the Amazon, but there's a great hole in what we don't know about South America and Latin America. Would you talk to us a little bit more about what happened in Venezuela under the dictator Nicolas Maduro? We have a 2024 article in Nature saying scientists in Venezuela are afraid to talk. Many have left the country and more want to. What happens to a country with no scientists?
No modern democracy can survive without science. I have to say that quite explicitly. Science provides a way not only of understanding what surrounds us, not only understanding the nature of the universe, of the environment, of ourselves, but also is a way of making knowledge available to all of us. And when you teach science, when you do outreach in scientific research, you are actually democratizing scientific knowledge. In the case of Venezuela, which is obviously a dictatorship, what you have is the absolutely lack of understanding of former President Chavez, current President Maduro, having very little support for science. And I think what they do, what they have done or what they do now is to think of science as done by an elite, and being strongly populist, having a strong populist attitude, for them, an elite of a group of experts, a group of specialists, is something they can quite easily identify and promote as enemies of the people. If you listen to the speeches of Mr. Maduro, for example, what you realize is that he's appealing all the time to common sense. Well, common sense is useful if you want to cross the street, but it doesn't provide you an understanding of the, let us say, the intricacies of ecological relationships in a given country. I think that science is an essential component of any current democratic culture.
Few people realize that Brazil is a major fossil fuel producer. They are the largest for petroleum in South America and the ninth largest in the world. How has science fared in Brazil?
Well, Brazil had a superb scientific community in the 60s. It was growing. The same was true in the case of Argentina. The same was true in the case of Chile. And then in the 70s, Latin America was strongly struck by military coups that ended up democratic regimes for a number of times. It's interesting to realize, for instance, that if you read Charles Darwin's Travels, the Journal of Travels, you can see how he described General Rosas, who was one of those caudillos typical of Latin American political culture in the 19th century. Well, caudillos normally have a very little understanding of the significance of culture and of science, and the same was true in the 1970s. Brazil's growing community, scientific community, was strongly weakened by the dictatorship. Many people had to leave the country, and when the democracy returned, you had a flowering group of students, of researchers, and they were, of course, very concerned, as all of us should be worldwide, about the future, the fate of Brazil. Now, we'll know how attacks by people there have no understanding of the significance, the ecological, the worldwide significance of the Amazon, had to face very serious threats. If you look at the number of people defending the environment that had been killed worldwide by illegal wood trade, by the destroying of the tropical forests and so on, you can understand the ordeals these people face. Well, happily, there are a number of European, how shall I say, foundations or groups, mostly Germany and Norway, they are supporting very strongly the groups of scientists protecting the Amazon, and this has certainly relieved the pressure, the political pressure that our Brazilian colleagues had to face.
There are many models in Latin America of how the new science purge by the Trump administration may unfold. Let's talk about another case from your editorial. Trump is very fond of the president of Argentina, Javier Milei. Talk to us about how science setbacks in Argentina are going.
Well, one should keep in mind that about three decades ago, Argentina had two Nobel Awards given to scientists, and it was an extraordinary sophisticated scientific environment. I remember when, as I got undergraduate students, I was reading all the time the books published by the publishing house called Eudeba. The translation will be Editorial Universitaria de Buenos Aires, which was very, very sophisticated. I've been twice to Argentina, and I had always felt at home. And given their sophisticated, their complex scientific and cultural life. Well, it turns out that Mr. Milei, the current president, has a very little understanding of the significance of science. He has cut the budget for science. He has threatened academic liberty. And if you look at the entire Latin America, and let me use Argentina as an example of what's going on, you see that we have an extraordinary identity, cultural identity. We have very strong common historical roots. And one thing that makes me extremely envious of the European Union is the fact that they have developed what they call the Erasmus program, in which you can have an undergraduate from Denmark going to Greece or a graduate student from Germany working in Spain. If a German student can feel at home in Spain, or an undergraduate girl from Denmark can work without any problem in a lab in Greece, it will be in principle more easy for, let us say, an Argentinian undergraduate student to feel at home in Guatemala. We have been unable to develop an equivalent program to the Erasmus in Latin America. And nowadays, well, since several centuries ago, science depends very strongly on exchange of ideas, on the free exchange of ideas, on the mobilizing people from one country to the other. And unfortunately, this has not been a goal of Latin American governments or societies for several decades.
And getting back to Mexico, your country elected a climate scientist, Claudia Sheinbaum Pardo. if I understand your editorial, this change may not be enough because we can't have this back and forth of politics every few years. Great science needs long-term stability, yes?
Absolutely. I think that, yes, indeed, the current president, whom I know, I mean, she was an undergraduate student at my school. Her mother was my TA. Her mother is also a scientist, was my TA for a year or so. But it doesn't, clearly, it doesn't suffice to have a scientific background if you're going to be a politician. What you also need is a very elaborate democratic system like those like that in Germany, where another scientist like the former Chancellor Merkel was able to develop a very, very elaborate, very proper response to the epidemic, the SARS epidemic, thanks not only to the fact that she was trained as a chemist, but also to the fact that the government recognizes, and that's a state in the laws of Germany, recognizes as a significance of the advice of scientists and the academic community. The same could be said, for instance, of England. Remember that Mrs. Thatcher was a chemist. She had a good background in chemistry. A couple of friends of colleagues of mine that I haven't seen for a while actually worked together with her in classes, and they recalled that she was an actually good chemist working on asymmetric synthesis. But then we saw the disaster that came on when she was unable to understand the significance of science and culture for the development of the UK system.
So, Antonio, what can the history of repression of free science in Latin America tell us about current defunding of climate science in America? Are there lessons we can learn there? Can we see something coming?
I think that one has to keep in mind that no modern democracy can be strengthened as such in the absence of a strong scientific system. Science is a universal patrimony. Science is something that has not only the system has the right to develop, but also should be reinforced as part of the politics of any current modern society. You're speaking of climate change. I will also speak about biodiversity, about the alternative developments of alternative energy sources, about the need to have a proper use, knowledge and use of our biological and mineral resources. And unless we develop a common policy for Latin America, I think we will be doomed for, to quote Garcia Marquez, for 100 years of intellectual solitude.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock from Mexico City. Our guest is Antonio Lazcano, professor at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. We are talking about repression of science in the Americas. When scientists are vilified on television and social media, like Anthony Fauci has been in America, that seems to erode public trust in scientific results. And then we get conspiracy theories and religious ideas might replace real science. How do you see it?
Well, I think it's interesting to say that for all the prejudices that exist in the Anglo-Saxon world, countries that have a strong Catholic background, like, for instance, Latin America, have no problem with science. For instance, only twice in my life I've had any problems with people preaching against evolution. And in both cases, they came from the USA. In Latin America, the ideas of Darwin are prosper and are very well accepted. So I don't think that the religious issue is that strong. My problem is that, or I should say the problem that everybody has, is when you disconnect the richness of scientific understanding from public and political policies. I think that's a real issue. There's an anecdote that I wonder how well-known it is in the United States, but I think it's very significant. There is a recent paper published in Nature in which a professor from Stanford analyzes the strength of American sciences, which by all means is the most, is the strongest worldwide. And he argues, and I think he's right, that during the Second World War, an extraordinary American engineer, Vannevar Bush, convinced President Roosevelt that one should develop an alliance between industry, universities, and the government in order to make science an element in the war against the Nazis. And then when the conflict, when the Second World War was coming to an end, Bush brought in a very famous piece that if science helped to win the war, science should help us to keep and maintain peace. Well, the outcome of that policy is an extraordinarily strong American scientific system as that in the United States. Many people are not aware that during his first term, Mr. Trump actually accepted that kind of advice. In early March, the 2020, when the epidemic, the pandemic was raging worldwide, he actually met with the leaders of the pharmaceutical industry, with a number of scientists like Dr. Fauci, and they Mr. Trump offered political support, fiscal facilities for the pharmaceutical industry to develop medicaments, to develop vaccines. And the outcome was the very quick development of the messenger RNA vaccines. As Dr. Fauci says in his memoirs, the Trump administration will be fairly proud of the fact that that alliance was made in 2020. It's a pity that Mr. Trump hasn't followed the same policy nowadays.
Well, people like Musk and Peter Thiel say, let business do it. Do you see a focus on applied science and commercialization of science as a danger? Can billionaires and private companies provide all the science we need?
Well, I think that big money has to be controlled democratically by societies. I have absolutely no qualms about seeing big money companies and so on doing applied science, as long as the applied sciences doesn't mean forgetting about basic science. In the 19th century, Claude Bernard, a rather well-known physician, French physician, said that it's not good to separate science into basic science and applied science. You have either good sciences or not. No one would have guessed, and this, remember, this is the centenary year of quantum mechanics, when support was given to quantum mechanics a century ago, nobody will have guessed that nowadays we will be using it in laptop or cell phones.
Do you think American foreign policy has contributed to the instability of scientific research in Latin America?
Quite on the contrary. I think that if you examine the many treaties and exchange programs that we used to have until recently, nobody knows what's going to happen to them in the near and medium-term future. Actually, the exchange program was quite extraordinary. I should underline the fact that Latin America science was enriched by the interaction with USA science, scientific community. I remember a very good friend of mine when he was appointed head of the biophysics and biochemistry department at the University of Houston, calling me and telling me, okay, we are quite close to Mexico. I'm head of the department. What can we do to promote exchange programs? I myself had a tremendous intellectual debt to my American scientists and colleagues who became my professors. So I think that any reasonable foreign policy of any country should actually promote those academic exchanges. And we have a direct example, dear Alex, of what can happen otherwise. Brexit actually cut in a terrible way the scientific ties of the UK with the rest of European science. And that has damaged British science in a terrible way, cutting support for projects, complicating the possibility of young scientists being trained in the UK and so on. So nowadays, the scientific system forms such an closely interwoven web that it's impossible to think that any country can be isolated either by foreign policies decisions or by cutting support or cutting exchanges and have a healthy scientific and educational system.
A lot of scientists that I talked to were baffled when their work with bugs or peat bogs or glaciers became political. They don't see research as a political issue. If we try to make a better world, can you, Antonio, think of arrangements or institutions which can protect long-term development of science and its accomplishments?
Well, not even continental drift will separate the United States from Latin America. We have to profit both parts of the continent from that very close relationship. Historically, geographically, the United States scientific development is tied to what goes on in Latin America. And remember that in the start of the 17th century, Giordano Bruno moved from Italy to Oxford. He was eventually kicked out, but because he was not an easy character. But remember that he's an example of those exchange of scientists, both male and female, that took place all over the world.
You spent a busy lifetime investigating the origins of life. I know you've been asked this 1,000 times, but if you had to bet, would you pick life arriving from space or something that happened biologically here on Earth?
I think life is a local phenomenon, but I think that one of the most outstanding results of NASA is the demonstration that if you look at the surface of Mars, of Venus, of the satellites of the outer planets, you see the remains of collisions with comets, asteroids, meteorites in the earliest stages of the history of our planetary system. I think that is telling us that a huge number of volatiles of carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, water sources enriched in a very significant way the surface of the Earth, and that actually provided the environmental condition for the synthesis of organic compounds and their evolution into the first cells.
Humans try to interpret evolution as a process leading to our wonderful selves. You teach that natural selection has no foresight, no goals, only results. Is life really that blind and cold?
Yes, but don't forget that blindness is guided by natural selection. Selection is a very powerful force, as Charles Darwin demonstrated in 1859 in The Origin of Species, that actually combines the randomness of the diversity of population with root that selects the most stable, most highly reproducible, more efficient systems.
Do you think there's a fundamental weakness in our minds that could limit scientific progress, understanding life on this planet and beyond, a kind of psychological barrier that we're running into now in the United States and in Latin America and other countries?
No, I don't think that has to do with psychology at all. I think that our psychological framework actually provides us with the richness of the intellectual curiosity to be open to new ideas, to defend the former ones, and to come out with reasonable results. I think that, on the contrary, I think that curiosity, intellectual curiosity, is a defining trait of human minds.
As we finish our time together, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I would like to, first of all, thank you for the time, for this exchange. Secondly, I would like to thank the media, because the media in Latin America and the United States have been all in all quite supportive of the efforts of science. One should remember the role that the media had, for instance, during the pandemic. I don't know if you had the chance to see the extraordinary articles by Carl Zimmer in the New York Times explaining what the virus is, how virus evolved, what the vaccines are. And I think that the media, all sides of media, whether the printed press or the web or radio programs and so on, has opened an extraordinary possibility for people to communicate, to exchange ideas. And what I would really like to say is that using the richness of the media, this possibility, is that our American colleagues should feel very supported by the Latin American community of scientists that recognizes without any problem the need to have a good scientific change that can enrich it all of us. I mean, without the media, there's a quote by Carl Sagan that I always mention to my students. When he brought the obituary of Isaac Asimov in Nature, he underlined the role that Asimov had in doing scientific outreach in books, in lectures, in the media. And he says, I remember that quite well, that the ultimate goal of Asimov was to democratize scientific knowledge. And I think this is actually what you are doing.
From Mexico City, we've been